regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards, and I am not guestless today. No. In fact, we've got a fantastic guest, Senate Minority Leader Jessica De La Cruz from Rhode Island. Got to be with us here in just a moment. You know, the Rhode Island legislature last Friday, last day of the session, passes a gun control bill that I don't think anybody's really happy with. Second Amendment supporters obviously not happy that a bill banning the sale, manufacture, and transfer of some of the most popular firearms in the country is soon going to become law in Rhode Island. Gun control activists aren't happy because the bill didn't go far enough. Well, at least I should say many gun control activists aren't happy. Groups like Every Town are saying, hey, listen, you know, it's one step at a time. But you've got anti-gunners like David Hogg and some of the state senators who voted for this bill saying, no, this bill should have gone farther. It should have banned the possession of these items as well. So chances are that this is not the last we have heard of a semi-auto ban in the state of Rhode Island. Now, during the debate on Friday in the Senate, and this, again, I mean, this went to the floor of the Senate by mid-afternoon on Friday, passed out, was brought directly to the House floor. Friday nights. I mean, this bill moved fast on the last day of session. I was watching this debate, and I was really struck by Senator De La Cruz and her advocacy for gun owners, her opposition to this bill. Reached out to her office to see if she could join me on the program. Didn't know if I'd hear back. I mean, again, the session's over. Figured she might want to take a few days or a few weeks to just relax and, you know, recharge the batteries. But nope, I heard back from her office very quickly. And Senator De La Cruz was able to join us this morning to talk about what went down last Friday and what is in store for Rhode Island gun owners. Take a look and a listen. Leader De La Cruz, thank you so much for coming on the program. It's really good to talk to you today.
Thanks for inviting me. I'm happy to be on.
Absolutely. Well, I was watching the debate last Friday, and I got to say, I was very impressed with what you had to say, with the amendments that you presented, with the arguments that you presented against this gun ban bill. I'm sorry to see that your colleagues were not receptive to what you and some other Republicans had to say. Let me just ask about the process before we get any further here, because, you know, this bill was there were Democrats who wanted to move this out of the Senate Judiciary Committee. They wanted to move it to a friendlier committee. We saw this last minute amended language instead, some sort of deal, I guess, brokered by the Senate President Valerie Lawson. Can you just talk about how this bill came to be and your thoughts on the appropriateness of how this bill actually got to the Senate floor and then over to the House on the last day of the session with hours left in this session?
Yeah. You know, from my understanding was that there weren't enough votes in the committee. And so I guess the threat was not to Republicans that they would move it out of another committee and then it would be passed in its original form, which was the most restrictive and most egregious. We were asked, all of us on the committee and ex officio, if we would vote for it because it was the lesser of evils. And, obviously we couldn't do that. And, you know, maybe I had the wrong idea, but I figured if it's going to pass, let it pass in its original form, as egregious as it is, and force someone to litigate it and hopefully have the Supreme Court hear it.
Yeah. And there was a lot of talk about, gun control activists. There were a lot of Democrat senators who said they were not happy voting for this watered down bill. We heard a lot about this bill needs to ban possession. It needs to ban possession. Right. So the bill that was passed by the Senate and the House, I'm sure it's going to be signed by Governor McKee. It does not explicitly ban the continued possession of these banned firearms. Right. It bans the sale and the transfer and the manufacture of these items. 10 years in prison, by the way, for an unlawful transfer, right? Mm-hmm.
Correct.
That's crazy. I mean, that's more than a lot of violent crimes, I'm guessing, in the state of Rhode Island.
Oh, sure. And as you can imagine, how many pieces of legislation we hear in judiciary about criminal justice reform. And, you know, we're just too tough on crime here in Rhode Island. But yet when it comes to, you know, possession. Now, imagine if something happens to a parent, they pass away and a child takes possession of those items because they belong to their parent. They've become a criminal.
Yeah. And in fact, one of the amendments that was offered by Republicans simply would have clarified that you can, if your parent, again, passes away, if you are willed one of these items, that you're not going to face criminal charges, right? And Democrats wouldn't even go along with that.
They wouldn't. And, you know, I remind people that when it's the unfortunate truth, but when you vote for a Democrat in Rhode Island, you are voting for whatever the president, Senate president, wants. So even though they may feel like, hey, Jess, that was a really good amendment, I don't know why they didn't put it in there. Well, why didn't you vote with me? Well, I couldn't because the Senate president said this, that, and the other. So, you know, it's not that the Republicans are, you know, better, even though I think we are, but it's that you're going to be voting for someone who can vote their conscience, who can vote freely on whether or not something is, you know, it's a good piece of legislation or not. And, you know, one of the Senate pages, they're usually high schoolers, came up to me and said, Senator De La Cruz, that was such a good amendment. It just made so much sense. I don't know why they didn't vote for your amendment. I said, well, you know, that's politics. And I tried to explain to them that we'll come back next year and we'll try. But even a teenager who's hearing this debate on the floor and says, this is just a common sense, sensible piece of legislation or amendment, why won't they go along with it?
Yeah. I mean, the same thing with the amendment that you offered that would have required the attorney general to come up with an annual report, just documenting how often these banned firearms are used in crime. Right. And we heard from Democrats, oh, this is gotcha language. You even said, kind of trying to preempt that, this isn't a gotcha. This is about getting the data. Right. But I guess there are a majority of senators who would rather willfully bury their heads in the sand rather than face the uncomfortable truth that they banned a lot of firearms that aren't used in a lot of crimes.
Right. And, you know, some of my arguments, you know, a committee, and it's not that I'm trying to ban, you know, handguns, but it's that we know that assault weapons, whatever that means, are not used in mass shootings. They're usually handguns. Mm-hmm. And so I know what the eventual path is. It's today we come for assault weapons, quote unquote. And next is, oh, well, the assault weapons ban didn't work. It has to be handguns. So we know that their eventual goal is really to eliminate the Second Amendment. And I know that some people say to me, that's crazy, Jess. They don't really want that. But they've said it in one way or another.
Well, I mean, absolutely. Listen, you can look at what's going on in California. There's a bill that would ban the sale of Glock handguns that just passed out of the state assembly. City of Chicago, the state of Illinois, trying to sue Glock and end sales of the most popular pistol in the country. As you say, they're going as far as they can, and then they're coming back for more, which gets us back to this language that David Hogg and others wanted that would have included a ban on the possession. Now, as I understand it, the House bill originally grandfathered in existing owners, so it wasn't an outright ban on possession, but that's clearly what they want. I mean, they explicitly said they want to make it a crime for people who lawfully purchase one of these firearms to continue to possess it.
Absolutely. Their goal is to eliminate the Second Amendment completely. It's not just about the firearms. It's about our right to defend ourselves. They want to eliminate it completely. And the House bill was so egregious. And I'm just going to pull up my notes here because I don't want to misspeak. But on the original bill, it would be the ban on manufacture, sale, purchase, and possession. It would criminalize possession unless the weapon was grandfathered, but you had to register it or surrender it or render it inoperable. And we have a law that's, you cannot register a firearm. We're not tracking Rhode Islanders, but this obviously would strike that from the law. And then it would require a voluntary certificate of existing assault weapons, and you would have to meet some compliance measures. The other interesting fact about the legislation was that you couldn't shoot on a friend's property. Now, I go to a range. Sometimes I go to a friend's house because they may have 100 acres, or you had to go to a licensed range. Well, there are no licensed ranges in Rhode Island. So as a gun owner, I wouldn't be able to even practice with my firearm to ensure that I'm, you know, a good shot, that I'm a responsible gun owner. It would just sit in my house. And so that was one of the most egregious parts of the legislation, because then what would happen is I go to my friend's house, he would be charged because I'm using his property. And if he happened to handle my firearm or move it, he would be charged as well.
And you could be charged for facilitating that illegal transfer, right?
Absolutely.
A temporary transfer. And, you know, and again, I mean, I wish that more folks had tuned into the Senate live stream on Friday, because it really was eye opening. I mean, you heard folks talk, you heard senators talk about the goal of this is to end the proliferation of these firearms. And as you know, as you pointed out, Justice Elena Kagan, writing for a unanimous Supreme Court, just talked about how these firearms are the most popular rifle in the country, talking about specifically the AR-15, widely legal, right? So we know that they're in common use for lawful purposes, which to me means that they're protected by the Second Amendment. And yet, again, the goal, the explicit stated goal is to eradicate, as you say, the Second Amendment, but specifically right now to eradicate semi-automatic center fire rifles, right? I mean, that's it, right? AR style pistols, semi-automatic shotguns, all of that. Again, they want to criminalize this to the point that you'd be better off, frankly, possessing heroin than an AR-15 in Rhode Island.
Oh my God, you couldn't have said it better. Absolutely. Yes.
So what are your concerns? I mean, again, Governor McKee is going to sign this. We know it. His popularity rating is, what, 6%? He's going to do anything right now to get even a handful of people to back him. What are your concerns for next session, given the rhetoric that we heard about we got to ban possession? Do you think they're going to come back next year and try to go for that?
Absolutely. That's one thing that I always tell Republicans is that, you know, they're looking for big wins. But when I look at progressives, they're happy with little wins, a little win here, a little win there, a little win, you know, over time ends up being this massive win. So I keep telling my Republican colleagues, even those just, you know, not in the building, we have to keep fighting. And even if we, you know, Ronald Reagan said, even if we, you know, move in inches and not in feet, it's still a victory. And so for them, they see that as well. Well, I'll take a little bite of the apple now. But if you can continue to take little bites of the apple, eventually that apple is going to be gone. And so absolutely count on them coming back and including the provisions that were removed. Will the legislature take it up? It's an election year. I'm not sure. This is one issue. I think that they have not received as much pushback, you know, as other issues in the past. And so I think that they have awoken a sleeping giant. And I think the Second Amendment community, which I've told them many times, what you need to do is you need to identify leaders like the Speaker, the Senate President, majority leaders, majority whips, judiciary chairs, and target them in their elections. And, you know, don't just target all of them and spread your resources thin because you don't have a lot of resources. But, you know, if you've raised $100,000, choose one of those people and target their campaign and unseat them. And I guarantee you that anytime the Second Amendment walks, you know, a representative of the Second Amendment walks into that building, they were going to take your call. They're going to meet with you in their office, and they're going to take very seriously what you have to say and consider whether or not they want, you know, a proverbial target on their back for election day.
I think that's exactly right. In fact, I noted at Bearing Arms when I was covering this that the one Democrat who was expected to vote against this bill on the Judiciary Committee, who ended up voting in favor of it, was unopposed in both the Democratic primary and the general election last cycle. That needs to change. He should face, frankly, I think the Second Amendment community needs to find a pro-gun Democrat and primary him. But I think they also need to find a Second Amendment Republican to challenge him in the general election. You're right. At the very least, these folks should face competitive elections. And I think you're spot on in talking about being strategic here in picking one or two races, focusing the resources there and sending a message. We saw this in Colorado more than a decade ago, where, you know, three supporters of gun control in Colorado were ousted in a special election, recall election. And that did make Democrats in Colorado sit up and take notice for a couple of years. Now, unfortunately, the state continued to drift leftward and they've continued to pass more gun control laws, but it bought gun owners a little bit of time. And I think in Rhode Island, we know that the Second Amendment community is there. I mean, how many thousands of people turned out in opposition to this bill? I mean, it was amazing. They packed the state house. So we know that they're there, right?
Year after year after year after year, they outnumber the redcoats, and I, you know, call them the moms red and or whatever they want to be called, but they outnumber them 10 to 1. And they almost wonder, does it really matter? I said, it does matter. You do have to show up. And I don't think there's an excuse for not showing up, because we're a part-time legislature. We don't meet during the day. We start at 4 o'clock. So when you get out of work, head to the state house. We're a teeny tiny state. It doesn't take more than 45 minutes if you're the furthest from the, you know, if you're in Westerly or Burrillville. It doesn't take that long to come to the state house and voice your opposition to bad legislation. So it does have an impact. But I think even more so is, can you walk with a candidate? Can you give up 2 weekends in your summer to canvass with them? Can you share their content on social media so that their reach is expanded? You know, can you donate $10? Sure. Yeah, you can do all of these things. And that would be, I think, even more impactful when it comes to your, you know, your influence at the state house.
Yeah.
But I would say, you know, to the point where you said that this legislation, maybe some feel that it's watered down, like in Colorado, where they were buying gun owners time. I feel that those more conservative Democrats felt like we're buying Rhode Islanders more time so that SCOTUS can take up these assault weapons bans. I get that. However, it's a really bad optic, because the Second Amendment community almost preferred the, you know, the more egregious version of the bill, just so that the Supreme Court would take notice.
Yeah, and I get that completely. You know, and I know that Justice Kavanaugh said he expects that the court will take up this issue in a term or two. You've got the Illinois cases that could get to the Supreme Court maybe by the end of the year. Depends on what the Seventh Circuit does. So, I mean, you know, there will be opportunities for the court to do this, but to your point, I mean, listen, a year from now, this law kicks in. There's a really good chance the Supreme Court will certainly not have heard and decided a case. It may not even have accepted a case dealing with this. And Rhode Islanders are still going to be subject to this unconstitutional law. And by the way, I fully expect in the next 12 months, the sales of these banned firearms are going to go through the roof in Rhode Island. Right. I mean, that's going to be the most immediate impact here. They're going to sell a lot of these guns.
Oh, yeah. And I said on the floor that, you know, it's the number one selling, they are is the number one selling firearm. Why? Because politicians want to ban it. So the more you want to ban something, the more popular you make it. It's kind of like telling a kid you can't have the cookie, right? Until after dinner or whatever. They're going to want that cookie so bad, they're going to, by any means possible, get their hands on that cookie. And for the gun owners, I hope they have a lot of firearms in stock, because they're probably going to become multimillionaires in 1 year.
Well, I mean, you know, and I'm sure that I wish them the best of luck. But again, the problem is what happens after that year's over, right? We saw this in Illinois. I've talked with FFLs that lost their business. You know, business was booming before the gun ban took effect. But when the gun magazine ban was in place, their sales dropped by 60, 70, 80%. They couldn't keep the lights on, and, you know, their livelihood was destroyed. So I'm sure that the FFLs would prefer to have that steady stream, right, rather than this huge surge and then a drop off the cliff 12 months from now. But that's not the world we live in, unfortunately. And again, Leader Dela Cruz, I just want to thank you and your colleagues for putting up the good fight, for trying to bring some common sense to this debate. I wish, again, that more folks had been able to watch this debate, but I really appreciate all of your efforts. And I'd love to have you back in the future, because I think we both agree this is going to raise its ugly head again next session.
It is. But thanks for having me on. And I'll talk to you again in the future.
All right. Senator Justice Dela Cruz joining us here on Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. I really do appreciate Senator Dela Cruz for joining us on the program. We're going to have her back, by the way, in a couple of weeks. We were talking after we stopped recording, and she was sharing her story about how she got into politics. I'll give you the brief version, but we're going to have her back to tell her story, because it really is. It's impressive. And she said the Second Amendment was what brought her into politics. Basically, her attempt to get a concealed carry permit and was denied for no reason whatsoever. And the frustration with that experience is what led her to run for office. And again, I mean, that's something that a lot of folks around the country have experienced. And as she talks about the importance of, you know, tactical advocacy, let's put it that way. I think she knows what she's speaking. So anyway, looking forward to having her back here on the show in the next couple of weeks or so. All right, let's turn our attention now to today's armed citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We'll start there with a case out of Boston, actually Roxbury, Massachusetts, where the Boston Globe reports court officers let a wanted man walk free, and 3 weeks later, he allegedly killed a woman. So this is a little different than our normal stories. This isn't a judge giving somebody a sweetheart plea deal or prosecutors saying, hey, you know what, you committed a violent crime, but we won't put you behind bars. Now, this really does seem like it was just a failure of these court officers to do what they were supposed to do. The Boston Globe reports 3 weeks before Kevin Boyette allegedly beat a 21-year-old woman to death last month in Mission Hill, a judge in Roxbury ordered court officers to arrest him on a warrant before he could leave the courthouse, but instead they allegedly let him walk out the door, according to court records. A docket entry from a court clerk says front door security looked like they were going to take him into custody, then proceeded to allow the defendant to walk back out. The Globe says that disclosure was among several listed in court records and other public documents reviewed by the paper that raised, quote, troubling questions over why Boyette was allowed to remain free in spite of a history of crime and violence. Yeah. So it sounds like while the court officers in question may be responsible for letting him walk this time, the criminal justice system in Massachusetts also bears some of the blame here. Boyette, who's 36 years old, had a lengthy record of aggravated assault and domestic violence charges, including allegations that he abused his girlfriend and threatened her family with a knife, and that in a separate incident, he groped a woman before stabbing her cousin. Now, again, doesn't seem like a gun was involved in any of these crimes, so maybe it doesn't really matter in Massachusetts. Unless you commit a crime with a gun, no big deal, right? If you possess a gun, even, you know, you commit a crime, you just possess one without a permit. Oh, that's a big damn deal. But, you know, stabbing somebody, aggravated assault, it's a knife, no big deal. According to the Boston Globe, Boyette allegedly killed Tatiana Flood on May 19th, according to prosecutors. Police responded to a call the following morning of a woman found in a wheelchair in the parking lot of a public housing development. They found her, blunt force injuries to her face, next to the Jeep where she was apparently killed. Surveillance video allegedly shows Boyette beating Flood with a hammer in the back of the Jeep, then dragging her body into a nearby wheelchair and then fleeing the scene. He was arrested on May 22nd. Ran on a murder charge, and Roxbury District Court pled not guilty. Right now, he's being held without bail, or it was held without bail. But three court officers have been placed on paid administrative leave in connection with the failure to apprehend Boyette and are now awaiting disciplinary hearings. According to the Boston Globe, in addition to this particular case in which the court officers allowed Boyette to leave, Boyette faced assault charges in two other cases, but they were dismissed this year after prosecutors reported that they were not prepared to go to trial. James Borgasani, a spokesman for the Suffolk DA's office, wrote that the two assault cases were dropped because the victims did not appear in court to testify. In one 2019 case, which was scheduled for trial in February, Boyette allegedly threatened a woman with a knife and threatened to, quote, shoot up the place. In the other case, Boyette was supposed to face trial in March for allegedly groping a woman last year, then stealing her phone and stabbing her cousin when he tried to intervene. In an interview with the Globe, the woman who was allegedly groped by Boyette acknowledged that she was reluctant to testify, but also said that she was not aware of the trial and had never received an order compelling her to appear in court. She said they should never have let him go. She said she hadn't wanted to testify because she wanted to move past the incident. She was focused on raising a new child, and she feared retaliation from Boyette's associates in the neighborhood. She had heard about Tatiana Flood's murder, but a Globe reporter told her that Boyette was allegedly responsible, and she says, you know, it does upset me that I could have testified and kept him in there. Now, this DA's office says they made multiple efforts to contact her, including issued a summons, and a judge had denied a request to continue to a later trial date. DA's spokesperson says our advocates made many attempts to contact this victim in the months, weeks, and days leading up to the trial. You know, I guess that's a he said, she said. But here's the thing. It does not surprise me if witnesses would be reluctant to testify, because what has happened with Mr. Boyette in the criminal justice system throughout his life? A lot of charges, not a lot of time behind bars, right? So even if Boyette had been sentenced to a lengthy prison term, again, this woman was afraid that his associates might come after her. And this is a problem that is not confined solely to Boston. If witnesses are afraid to testify because they fear retaliation, then cases do fall apart. violent criminals walk. And it is up to prosecutors, it is up to the state to ensure that witnesses feel safe. That is why we have things like the Witness Protection Program. It doesn't always, by the way, involve relocating somebody to a new city with a new identity, right? It can be simply making sure that there are extra police patrols around their residence or around their workplace for a specific period of time, right? It could also, not necessarily officially, but it could also involve helping that individual protect themselves, which, again, we're talking about Massachusetts, right? That's not going to happen. If this woman decided, you know what, I'm afraid for my life if I testify against this guy, so I want to buy a gun so that I can protect myself. The state of Massachusetts puts up so many roadblocks between her and her right to keep and bear arms that I wouldn't be surprised if she just threw up her hands in disgust, if she even entertained the possibility. But again, you've got multiple failures here of the criminal justice system, of court officers, and it sounds like those failures were at least indirectly responsible for the death of a 21-year-old woman, because the alleged killer could have and should have been behind bars instead of on the street. Now, today's Armed Citizen story from Pritchard, Alabama, where a teen who was trying to rob a gas station was shot and killed early Saturday morning. According to the Mobile County Sheriff's Office, it was about 3:35 Saturday morning. 17-year-old male shot by the manager of a Lucky 7 gas station during the attempted robbery. The would-be robber fled the scene on foot, made it, I guess, a short distance away, where he collapsed and was pronounced dead by medical personnel who arrived there to render aid. He sustained a gunshot wound to the right side of his chest. He was found wearing a hoodie, a mask, orange gloves. Investigators said he also found a 9mm pistol next to his body. The Mobile County Sheriff's Office said the same store was robbed by a similarly attired subject back on June the 9th. So this 17-year-old may have been responsible for more than one robbery in the area. The case has been turned over to the Mobile County DA's office, but given what the sheriff has reported here, I mean, this is a pretty clear-cut case of self-defense. Guy comes in with a gun, tries to rob you. You have a legitimate fear for your life, and you would be entitled to act in self-defense under those circumstances. It is a, you know, I don't take a whole lot of glee or joy in defensive gun uses where the perpetrator shot and killed. I just don't. I see it as a tragedy. I see it as a waste of a life. I don't fault the individual for acting in self-defense. I fault the criminal for putting somebody in the position where they have to use a firearm to protect their life. But it is still tragic. I mean, the 17-year-old should have been, you know, maybe getting ready to start his senior year in high school, should have been thinking about his plans for the future, should not have been out at 3:30 on a Saturday morning with a gun trying to commit an armed robbery. It does raise all kinds of questions about, you know, was his family aware of his nocturnal activities? Did he have a previous record? Was he known to law enforcement? But ultimately, again, it was the 17-year-old who put himself in that position. It was the 17-year-old who put himself in that situation. And it was the store manager who was justified in using deadly force to protect his life. My hope, and I know it's not likely to happen, but my hope is that this will resonate with other would-be criminals there in Mobile County. And they will perhaps think twice about engaging in these lawless activities on their own. Stick to the straight and narrow so they can avoid the fatal consequences of their crimes. All right, on to today's good deed of the day in New Mexico, where wildfires have broken out. A woman in the state saved an elderly neighbor and several dogs from this fast-moving fire. KOAT in Albuquerque reports this happened on Saturday. As of yesterday, 9 structures reported lost in what's called the Desert Willow Complex fire. 36 other structures have been affected by smoke impacts or drops of slurry to try to fight the fires. On Monday, KOAT spoke with a woman named Michaela Drew, who lives in the area. She said that it was Saturday. Her three-year-old daughter actually told her about the fire while on their way home. She said, I was just driving right down the road. She said, my daughter said, oh, no, there's smoke. And she said, I called 911 right away. I pulled down Willow Court, which is where the fire started originally. She said, I got out of my car with my daughter, and then I knocked on her, meaning her neighbor's door, or I rang her doorbell and told her there was a fire, because she had no idea that there was a fire. It was an elderly woman. In my mind, she says, I'm thinking I have to knock on this door to save that woman. She said it was scary. They had no idea that there was a fire behind their house. So I was like, well, I have to let these people know that there's a fire because they have no idea. So Michaela Drew ended up informing the elderly woman, you need to get out of there right now. She said then everybody started running out of their houses with their hoses, and that's when it really took off. She said other neighbors had smelled smoke, so they started opening their doors. She said, honestly, none of them had any idea until I knocked on that door, let her know, and then everybody started evacuating. She said, my mom and my sisters were rescuing dogs because people were evacuating, so they were rescuing. She said, we saved 4 dogs in total. So they were saving all of the animals from the houses that were burning or getting ready to burn. So, again, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing to save people and pets from a fast-moving fire. Michaela Drew and her family and all of the other Good Samaritans, I'm sure that there were plenty of folks there who did respond in their own way to try to get their neighbors and their family to safety. We thank you for your very, very good deed. The fire not contained, a lot of structures burned, but so far, no reports of any injuries or deaths. And that is, again, in large part to the quick thinking and the fast action of these Good Samaritans. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam and Company. I want to thank you for being a part of the program. As always, I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Don't forget, by the way, Wednesdays, we do our weekly VIP Gold or VIP Platinum live chat with Hot Air's Ed Morrissey. It is your chance to ask us about the big stories of the week. We can talk about the One Big Beautiful Bill. Maybe we'll have some language from the Senate parliamentarian about whether or not the NFA provisions, repealing taxes and registration requirements on suppressors, short barrel firearms, any other weapons, will survive the bird bath. Might not be until Wednesday night, but we'll be able to talk about it. And I'd love for you to be a part of that. In fact, if you just go to bearingarms.com/subscribe, you can become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. We've got all kinds of great benefits for you, including those weekly live chats, but we certainly do appreciate your support. Also, on tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking with Larry Keene from the National Shooting Sports Foundation, the NSSF, asking the ATF for some relief in terms of paperwork requirements. They're also asking that the ATF get rid of records from FFLs that are no longer in existence, at least those records that are more than 20 years old. We'll also get Larry's thoughts on Pam Bondi defending the proposed merger between the ATF and the DEA. Again, we'll do that on Wednesday's Bearing Arms Cam and Company. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from across the nation. And we look forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Enjoy the rest of your 2A Tuesday. Until then, be well. Until we talk again, be well. Be safe. Yes, be cool. I'm going to say it once again. And be free.